China issued its 2015 White Paper on National Defense Tuesday, which calls for a strategy of active defense to effectively deter threats and better protect the country's national interests. The document also lays out the developing trend of its military capabilities. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was quick to seize on the new strategic framework outlined in the White Paper to help him sell his continuing attempts to expand the set of circumstances under which Japan can use its military to Japan's parliament.
I won't name a particular country again and again, but there is a country in the Asia-Pacific region building up its military power. Take what's happening in the South China Sea or in the East China Sea. It is important to preserve peace and stability by maintaining the military balance and deterrence. We should not show any seam in our defense.
For its part, China was quick to respond to the criticism from Abe. This was Hua Chunying from China's foreign ministry at a press conference Wednesday.
China suffered a long time from foreign aggression and humiliation after entering the modern age. We value peace, oppose wars, adhere to the path of peaceful development, and pursue a national defense policy with a defensive nature. Meanwhile, historical lessons teach us that we must build a national defense power that is matched with national security needs and economic development level. We will never allow any country to violate China's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Earlier this week, China lodged a complaint with Washington over yet another incident involving a U.S. surveillance plane which flew over disputed territory in the South China Sea. And as we've previously reported, former top CIA official Michael Morell said last week that he believed a U.S. war with China was a real possibility. And another prominent voice, billionaire George Soros, also raised that concern in an article published last Friday by the Russian news agency Sputnik, where he was quoted as saying that there is a real danger that China will align itself with Russia politically and militarily, making a threat of a third world war become real. He suggested that the U.S. bind China to the Western-dominated global system by allowing its currency to join the International Monetary Fund's monetary system. With more on that, we spoke with Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst and visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York.
First, in the larger historical sense that Soros often relates to, which makes his commentary have a greater depth than most of the others that one hears. He's trying to tell us, or remind us perhaps, that economic warfare has a nasty habit of degenerating into military warfare. It has happened so often, particularly in the last 200 or 300 years, when capitalism has been the dominant economic system, that to not worry about it is what would have to be defended. In other words, he's pointing out what should be the common anxiety across the world, rather than the absurd complacency about these issues that informs most other comments. Second point, where does that complacency come from beside historical amnesia? The answer is the symbiotic or co-dependent relationship between China and the United States, or indeed between China on the one hand and what we would have to call the old centers of capitalism, Western Europe, North America, and Japan. And the basic relationship there is as follows. Capitalists in those old centers, U.S., European, Japanese, have been making a fortune of money in their interactions with China. Let me briefly explain. On the one hand, they have been able to keep down the wages they pay their workers because those workers can take fairly stagnant wages and keep buying more stuff thanks to China and its ability to deliver consumer goods at declining prices. In other words, you might think of it to be graphic for a moment. Over the last 30 to 40 years, Western working classes in North America, Western Europe, and Japan broadly defined, those working classes have been able to shift over from clothing that was relatively expensive, produced in their own societies, to clothing imported from China, which is much cheaper. The same has been true of appliances of various kinds, of construction materials, more recently of more developed goods, everything from automobiles to machinery and equipment. The bottom line is that China has become a power by exporting such items to the Western capitalists as gave them more profits. So this was a very useful partnership. Indeed, the profitability of producing in China for export helps explain why more than half of what flows out of China, mostly to North America, Western Europe, and Japan, is produced by subsidiaries of U.S., European, and Japanese corporations. So they've made money on both ends. They've been able to cheapen their labor costs by importing Chinese consumer goods, and they've cashed in on record profits producing those goods for export inside China. So when you look at all of that, you can come to the conclusion, if you have historical amnesia, that this codependency will mean that everything is hunky-dory, both sides understand the money they're making from each other. The capitalists in Western Europe, North America, and Japan wouldn't let their governments do anything militarily stupid that could undermine this profitable relationship, etc., etc., etc. And the Chinese have no interest, it would be argued, in upsetting this lovely arrangement, which is netting them the most remarkable historical experience probably in the last 1,000 years, which is the transformation in unbelievably short historical times, literally 30 years, from one of the most backward and undeveloped economic systems to the second global economic superpower, to the United States, and catching up to the United States spectacularly. For example, over the last 3 or 4 years, when the average annual growth of output in the United States was in the 1 to 2% range, whereas in China it was in the 7 to 10% range. With those kinds of differences, the narrowing of the gap is stunning. So the Chinese, it is argued, have no reason to upset the apple cart, and likewise, neither do the old capitalist centers. The problem with this analysis is, again, historical amnesia, because in the past, exactly those kinds of symbiosis existed between countries who eventually went into catastrophic wars against one another, the ultimate being World Wars I and II, which weren't that long ago. So I think the bottom line is that where there is codependence, and by the way, this is as true in interpersonal psychological relationships as it is between countries, where there is codependence, there is also immense anxiety on the part of both partners to the codependence that at some point the other partner will find someone else to dance with, someone else to carve a relationship with, some way to try to make even more money at the expense of one's codependent partner, and to ward against that, all kinds of steps are taken, which then run out of control, and the codependency turns into military war. Let me give you an example of how that's happening now. The United States is on a tear to undo, based on the Cold War legacy, which is very much with us, to undo what was the former Soviet Union. And in the quest to do that, to pry away from what was the Soviet Union, to pry away from what remains, mostly Russia, the varying other republics that together formed the USSR. And right now the focus is on a very big one, the Ukraine. That threatens Russia. Russia is now going to be looking for alternative partners to the growing cooperation with the West that had characterized Russian policy before. And the place they look first is China. And they remind China that the United States could do to you what they are doing to us here in Russia whenever they may see fit to do so. So you ought to partner with us for the same protective reasons that we are partnering with you. And over the last 24 months, a spectacular rapprochement economically between Russia and China, although the press coverage in the West of this is minimal because it runs against the rationales for what is going on. But I see that Mr. Soros is right, that the very blindness and deafness to the historical analogy, the very inability to see squarely where your policies lead, to act as if you did not have to care about how this plays out, that you're always in the immediate moment of the TV spotlight. Soros looks, for example, at the Iraq and Afghanistan adventures, which is how he understands it, as having to be understood as great publicity at the beginning, not seeing where this goes, and then getting caught up in a long losing battle, as today's headlines from both countries point out so clearly. He doesn't want the same to happen with China, because then we're in a quagmire that could extinguish us as a society, which is something that at least the smallness of Afghanistan and Iraq make unlikely.
And perhaps even as a species. Looking at some points of, potential flashpoints, certainly some points of contradiction between capitalists in the West and China, the elites in China, the domestic elites. If you look at the situation in Latin America and the Caribbean, for example, with China making huge deals with individual countries and, being present at the CELAC conference as a guest of honor, building the new canal through Nicaragua, the Transcontinental Railroad, and others, and the U.S. positing the TPP as a sort of a parry to that thrust. Do you see any of these areas of actual competition between the elites as potential flashpoints?
Absolutely, although I would want to ground whatever it is these various elites do in the underlying pressures. The elites are followers. They love to pretend they're in command of the situation. But that is a kind of childish arrogance that really doesn't merit taking them seriously. Here's the problem for China first and then for the United States. The Chinese have embarked consciously on an unbelievable transformation in their economic situation over the last 30, 40 years. I mean, I cannot overemphasize that. They are basically moving hundreds of millions of people out of rural and agricultural pursuits that have characterized these people for many, many generations, and moving them in an unbelievably short time into the urban industrial life, particularly of the major cities and the major coastal regions of China. This is happening in a flash. They are moving these people. These people are moving themselves as life in the countryside becomes impossible. They are moving to the cities where there's barely enough housing and accommodation and infrastructure. They're racing to make that up to those people. They are betting everything on being able to accommodate this shift. And that means exporting commodities, because they've built an export-based economic system. They produce the goods that were sold and continue to be sold, above all, in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, and now secondarily elsewhere in the world. They are an exporting machine. Now, they're trying to change that. They're trying to refocus more on the domestic market, but that takes time. And they don't have time when it comes to accommodating their people. So their elites, their governing circles, their ruling groups, however you want to call it, are under an incredible pressure never to slow the economic growth of their exports alongside whatever they can do to redirect it domestically, but simply to provide jobs for the hundreds of millions that keep moving into their industrial sector. So here you are, you're stuck in this situation. They don't have much wiggle room. In order for that to work, they have to keep the currency, the price of their currency in terms of other currencies, low. They have to make it easy and cheap for people in other parts of the world to convert their currencies, the dollar, the euro, the yen, whatever, into Chinese yuan in order to purchase the exploding volume of exports coming out of China. Now fast forward to the United States. The United States has a different set of compulsions. On the one hand, it faces a desperate, vast middle sector of its working class, the people who used to have fairly secure, fairly well-paid jobs that allowed them, especially if both husband and wife worked, to live the quote-unquote American dream, or at least a rough approximation. Those people are being abandoned in the United States. Why? Because the capitalist industries are moving into China, India, and Brazil, having learned already years ago that they cannot beat the Chinese at what they're doing, becoming an export powerhouse. They made the strategic decision to join them, that is, to close their factories in North America, Western Europe, and Japan on the one hand, and move them to China, India, Brazil, and so forth on the other. Those capitalists' anxiety, which they pass on to their political representatives in Washington, is that the mass of American people being abandoned by capitalism will turn nasty, ugly, and bitter. And if you are awake, you may have noticed that, whether you look at the rhetoric of the Tea Party or you look at the behavior of our police departments, all the signs of psychological distress, material deprivation, the first new numbers showing that people enrolling in community colleges shrank over the last couple of years by 5% because they can't afford to go to the schools that might have gotten them out of the working class, et cetera, et cetera. The signs are everywhere. That's a fundamental compulsion. Meanwhile, they can't move against China because the capitalists of the United States are among the major pressures not to mess with the arrangement with China, because they've now joined that process and they are as dependent for their profits on exporting cheap stuff to the United States than are the Chinese themselves. The problem is this co-dependency can blow up. The Chinese have to expand their exports. The United States, on the one hand, gains from it, but domestically suffers in all kinds of ways by the pinch that comes when the Chinese are successful. They may be tempted, therefore, to try to counter-pinch. Yeah, but there we are again. We're now moving from economic warfare into a temptation to find military warfare. You could see the temptation in the Ukraine with American players beginning to provide advisors to Ukrainian military that are fighting the Russians. Wow, where is that going to go? And it wouldn't be very hard to come up, given the size of China, with boundary problems there that the United States military might be tempted to engage in. You have to remember, finally, in this equation, and I'm sorry it's complicated, but that's the way this is, you have to remember that the United States is itself a declining power. That is, the relative importance of other parts of the world in the world economy is rising, and the relative importance and weight of the United States is shrinking. And one of the ways this plays itself out is that American policymakers, American elites, see their political influence shrinking, see their economic footprint shrinking, And then notice that there's one area that they supervise, that they watch, which isn't shrinking relatively, partly because they spend so much money on it, and that's the military. So then you get into a very dangerous situation that the one dominant superiority that American elites still dispose of as they watch the economic, the political, and the cultural influence wane is the temptation to use your strong card, your powerful card, to try to offset or compensate for the shrinking power in the other domains of life. And that is the scariest prospect of all.
If you had to give it percentages, which way it's going to go, what's your guess? It's a casino.
It's a crazy casino. I am so, frankly, I'm so overwhelmed at the unspeakable tragedy that the peace of this planet, the survival of this planet, either from ecological destruction or from a cataclysmic world war that we will never recover from or it'll take centuries, I'm overwhelmed by the tragedy that, as you put it, elites, small groups of people who are fundamentally insulated from responsibility to the mass of their people are in a position to make such decisions, have even the capacity for the kind of conversation you and I are having to make that happen, that conversation, that I don't know how to answer a question of probabilities. I am frightened to death, I don't mind saying it, by the irresponsible, wildly irresponsible speeches that come particularly from the political right in the United States, who seems to have lost all sense of what the reality is as they pander to the fading fantasy of a superpower that is on the down, on the decline, and that cannot face the reality, which is that that decline is first and foremost the results of the largest businesses in the country deciding that they can make more money paying the low wages in Russia and China and India and Brazil than they have to pay here in the United States, and are kissing the American working class goodbye and going to the greener profit pastures overseas. That's why the balance has shifted as fast as it has. That's why the United States' position is declining. That's why in the midst of the collapse of the middle class, the upper class in the United States, the top 5-6%, and it's no more than that, could care less, doesn't even know what's going on in the rest of the country, hides behind its own dominance of the media to tell itself comforting stories, because since they are the ones who work for these big corporations and or own shares in them, they're cashing in on the higher profits that motivated the abandonment of the American people. And so they don't care. They don't pay attention. They don't care. Everything is going well for them. They've recovered from the crisis of 2008. And the rest of the people, the bottom 85 or more percent, stare and wonder at whether they're living on the same planet. This is a highly dangerous situation, explains this sort of pandering on the part, particularly of the right, to this foregone notion that we are powerful, we can do whatever we want, we will punish the bad guys, we are the good guys. This is childish junk. Had a little bit of sense in that interregnum, you might call it, after World War II, when all the other powers of the world had been destroyed and the United States stood alone as the country that had no war on its soil other than the short moment in the Pearl Harbor and had provisioned the winning side in the World War. So yeah, from the late 40s until the late 70s and 80s, everything was here in America allowed these fantasies. But the bottom line is that's over. Nothing like that is on the horizon. It isn't going to happen like that anymore. And the language of the right, the militants, the saber rattling, the absurd conversations that seem to come from outer space, that disconnect with the underlying reality, I don't see that in China. I see them as the people coming up with all the self-confidence that that builds, but having a much firmer grip on their difficult real situation, whereas Americans are spinning off into fantasy that I find ultimately frightening.
Professor Wolf, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate the chance to talk to you and hope we can do it again in the future.
Thank you.